Welcome.
You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello. Welcome to the Black Experience Hour. This is a weekly program and is being recorded for the listening week that begins March 16th. Your reader's name is Susan Shirey. This week's featured sources include, among others, thegriot.com, blackenterprise.com, blacknews.com, the Boulder Daily Camera, among others. Opening with the Boulder Daily Camera, print edition, published March 8th. Bold, black, beautiful art exhibits bring more than just 1 month of black art to galleries. Written by Ella Cobb. If a friend from out of town were to ask, "What's Boulder like?" certain descriptive imagery capturing a progressive, laid-back oasis would probably come to mind. Blissed-out hippies drinking kombucha by the creek. Scenic vistas featuring rock formations perfect for trad climbing. An egregious amount of organic grocery stores to be found within the same 4 square miles. But words that you would likely never use to describe Boulder? Racially diverse. Anyone who's lived in Boulder over the past century, or those who've researched the city before visiting, has seen the stats. Boulder County is blindingly white, with 89.5% of the population identifying as such, compared to a mere 1.3% identifying as black, according to the latest U.S. Census numbers. In a city known for a lack of diversity, one artist is taking the initiative to ensure that black voices are heard and black representation is seen. Through a series of art exhibitions in Boulder, titled Black Futures in Art, Can You Hear Me?, it presents the work of internationally acclaimed and local emerging artists to a community where black perspectives frequently feel overlooked. Quote, Black Futures in Art is a series that was created by organizer and curator Adderley Grant Lord as a way to highlight black artists in conjunction with Black History Month. But as the years have passed, Grant Lord, a Boulder-based abstract artist, realized that the exhibitions can and should go beyond just a single month. Quote, I got to thinking there should be at least 3 months out of the year where people can come into our city and see that we're trying to be more diverse and inclusive and see us highlighting all of these black artists, Grant Lord said. It doesn't need to be just 1 month. Black art deserves more than just 1 month. Since then, quote, Black Futures in Art has brought in exhibitions and events all over the county, spanning several months, from intimate galleries at small churches in Boulder, to a cozy coffee shop in Lafayette, to in-person demonstrations in Longmont. According to Grant Lord, the title for the exhibition came from a desire to create a more inclusive community for generations to come. Quote, I have a 17-year-old daughter who grew up here, and she had a really hard time, Grant Lord said. Quote, her goal is to move away and not come back because she felt like there was no place here for her. So these exhibitions, they're for my kids and for my kids' classmates and for all of the ones that will come later. I don't want them to have the same experience my daughter had, end quote. Black Futures in Art refers to the idea of Afrofuturism, the cultural and artistic movement that presents futures and realities where black people play central and empowered roles. This year, Black Futures in Art has translated into a total of 3 exhibitions in Boulder. One at the Nobo Art Center, an exhibit that recently closed. Another at First Congregational Church, which is on display through March 21st. And this larger exhibition at the Dairy Arts Center, which will run through April 6th. Quote, "It's been great that so many galleries have wanted to feature us, because I still don't think a lot of people in Boulder know that this art exists," Grant Lord said. "I don't believe that there is an exhibition that has put forward as many African American artists of this caliber in Boulder. There really is talent on these walls," end quote. But not all venues or gallery spaces in Boulder have been receptive to Grant Lord's vision of an exhibition featuring all Black artists. According to Grant Lord, a particular art gallery in downtown Boulder, which she preferred not to name publicly, refused to host the exhibition after claiming that the art would make business clientele, quote, "uncomfortable." Grant Lord said, "Boulder can be heartbreaking for me because it can claim to be so inclusive, but then there are some places that don't want to show art featuring Black futures because it makes them uncomfortable. What about Black futures makes you uncomfortable?" End quote. Grant Lord's query opens the door for the bigger question. Is Boulder as progressive as it tries to appear? Black Futures in Art, Can You Hear Me? Features art that is vibrant, evocative, contemplative, and gorgeous. It would, in this reporter's opinion, elevate the walls of any venue in Boulder. The exhibitions at both the Dairy Arts Center and First Congregational Church feature artists who represent a dynamic cross-section of esteemed Black creatives from all over the world, including Gedeon Nyong'ongo, Colin Nyong'ongo, Louise Cutler, Thomas Lockhart, John Toms, Kevin Johnson, Lashun Beal, Lydia Carlos, Jasmine Henley, and Grant Lord. For Kevin Johnson, a Colorado-based painter, concept artist, and graphic designer, being a part of the exhibition at the Dairy Arts Center is an honor. Quote, "It is great to share this space in this show with this caliber of artist," Johnson said. "I couldn't pass it up. This is also an opportunity to share my art with a new community that hasn't seen my work," end quote. Johnson's work focuses on portraiture, inspired by the belief that every individual possesses a unique and compelling narrative. Through his portraits, Johnson seeks to unravel the stories hidden within his subjects, capturing the essence of their experiences and emotions. Quote, "I love doing portraiture because everyone has a story to tell, and I think portraiture has a way of letting you see that story," Johnson said. "It could be someone who is having a good or bad day, and by looking at them, you want to know more about what's going on in their lives," end quote. Through his art, Johnson encourages viewers to delve deeper into their own selves and to appreciate the interconnectedness of humanity with the universe and nature. His pieces evoke a sense of introspection and appreciation for life's intricacies, urging us to find joy and fulfillment in the midst of our journey. One of Johnson's pieces, a charcoal drawing titled Reflection, captures the essence of a young African-American man deeply immersed in contemplation of nature's beauty. The artwork portrays the subject in a serene moment, connecting with his surroundings and embracing the harmony of life. The piece invites the viewer to stop, take a deep breath, and share in the young man's tranquility. Quote, "I want the audience to take away a new love for art and feel the connection with everyone, no matter what ethnic group they come from," Johnson said. "I just want them to be inspired. My work explores futurism, positivity, spirituality, strength, and empowerment. Basically, knowing that we are still learning more about our past, But at the same time, we have to be in the present and prepare for the future, which means we have to keep informed, learn about technology, especially these days as it is advancing at a fast pace. End quote. Throughout all of the noise, Johnson wants to remind us that there's always time to connect with the natural world, hoping that with his work, viewers will, quote, learn more about the world and see things that really matter, and to simply enjoy life while looking deeper into ourselves and see how we are connected to this vast universe. While Johnson's art creates a moment of quiet contemplation for viewers, artist Thomas Lockhart's pieces inspire audiences to get up close and personal with Black history. In his piece, The Prophet, Lockhart presents a collage-style painting immortalizing the likeness and the words of the writer James Baldwin, who gazes out of the canvas with a look of quiet wisdom. Flanking Baldwin are smaller profiles of civil rights leaders Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., while poems, quotes, and rally cries from Baldwin frame the three civil rights leaders, encapsulating the essence of their collective advocacy and enduring legacy. A Denver native now living in Aurora, Lockhart is a mixed-media artist who draws inspiration from a myriad of sources, including music, nature, current events, history, and spiritual teachings. As shown in The Prophet, Lockhart's work serves as a testament to the stories of both the present and past generations. While some of his art lives in the second dimension, some of Lockhart's more contemporary pieces seamlessly integrate three-dimensional elements, such as coins, silk flowers, and jewels, adding depth and texture to his compositions. One of his paintings, which was featured at the prestigious Art Basel in Miami in 2021, brought Biggie Smalls to life in a portrait that featured a 14-karat gold necklace and a real fur coat. Quote, "I believe as young children we love to touch stuff," Lockhart said, "and we still love to do that as we're older, but we don't engage with that sense of feeling because, as kids, we're told not to touch things. But we love textures. We love how things feel on our skin, and it's a part of our DNA and helps our understanding of the world around us to be able to do that." End quote. Lockhart said he was compelled to participate in the Black Futures in Art exhibition because of its profound resonance with his artistic vision and mission. Quote, "Everybody has some form of creativity in them. Everyone is an artist in their own individual way," Lockhart said. "With these pieces, I hope that people would look at them and see a future, and also gaze on the past and see from whence we came and how far we can move forward," end quote. Lockhart added, "It's important for all of us to work together to move forward, to make every space for everybody to be comfortable, and to live in a society where you have the ability to move forward if you choose to." Throughout the Dairy Arts Center exhibit, works of art in all different colors, shapes, mediums, and sizes illustrate the walls, with each artist bringing a little something different to the table. There's the delicately powerful floral, Asian-inspired paintings of Louise Cutler, the playful works of John Toms, whose vibrant pieces travel outside of the frame, the sensuous impressionism paintings of Lashun Beale, Gideon Nyanghong, and Colin Nyanghong's intricate Zimbabwe Shona sculptures, the futuristic AI-driven portraits of Lydia Carlos, Jasmine Henley's contemporary textile and acrylic creations, and Grant Lord's bright and hypnotic abstract art. Black Futures in Art, Can You Hear Me?, invites visitors to engage firsthand with narratives of the Black experience. Quote, "With these exhibitions, you gotta get up close and personal," Grant Lord said. You're going to see things that you don't normally see in Boulder, and that's a good thing if you expose a child or another human being to all of these other facets of life. Do you know how much more their brain will open up? End quote. She added, to create change, your perspective has to change. I hope that one of these days, having an all-black art exhibition won't be rare in Boulder. And I especially hope that one day, people will no longer be uncomfortable by the idea of black futures. End quote. Artworks from Black Futures in Art, Can You Hear Me? Are on display at First Congregational Church until March 21st and the Dairy Art Center until April 6th. Both exhibitions are free of charge, separate from Grand Lord's series, but Highlighting Black Art is a partnership with the University of Colorado Boulder and the Museum for Black Girls in Denver to create an exhibit called We See You. That's spelled with the two letters, C-U. Colon, a visual celebration of black womanhood, presence, and connectedness. On display at the CU Art Museum through July 13th, the exhibit celebrates black women and invites visitors to reflect on the profound impact they have had on shaping the concept of home, both as a physical space and as a metaphorical sanctuary of strength, resilience, and cultural richness. Learn more at cuartmuseum.colorado.edu. Turning next to thegrio.com. This written by David A. Love, posted March 14th. The latest crisis in Haiti. How did we get here? This is an opinion piece. Some observers may conclude that black people simply cannot govern themselves, but Haiti, the first free black republic, has never been able to catch a break under the weight of colonial oppression and imperialist occupation. Editor's note, the following article is an op-ed, and the views expressed are the author's own. The Caribbean nation of Haiti is in utter turmoil as the country's Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, has announced his resignation this week in the midst of international pressure. This, as most of the capital city of Port-au-Prince is controlled by armed street gangs, actually paramilitary groups, who freed thousands of people from prison and united to consolidate power. Plans were afoot but now halted to deploy 1,000 Kenyan police, backed by the United Nations, to Haiti to control the violence. Following the 2021 assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse, and the removal of all democratically elected institutions, with the failure to hold elections as the terms of all remaining members of the Senate expired last year, Haiti has become a de facto dictatorship. These circumstances have fueled the gangs, who are now independent after being financed and armed by government officials and Haitian oligarchs, and their killing, kidnapping, and extortion. How did this happen? Making sense of the crisis taking place in Haiti means understanding the most recent events unfolding with the role of the gangs. More importantly, however, is an unpacking of the historical context behind Haiti, a country that has been denied true independence and self-determination for 220 years. Considering what is unfolding in this African diasporic nation, it is easy for observers to conclude that black people simply are unable to govern themselves, not realizing that Haiti was never able to catch a break under the weight of colonial oppression and imperialist occupation. The first independent black republic has been punished for liberating itself, while the U.S. and other Western powers have propped up dictators in Haiti and economically exploited the people. First free black republic. With its independence in 1804, Through a revolt of enslaved Africans against France, Haiti became the first free black republic and served as a role model and inspiration for oppressed and enslaved black people in the United States and beyond. George Washington was concerned about an international, quote, spirit of revolt among the blacks, end quote. That started in Haiti, saying, quote, when it will stop, it is difficult to say. The governor of South Carolina warned Washington that white people were outnumbered by Africans in his state in a, quote, nearly similar situation as Haiti. The rebellious black people of Haiti succeeded in overrunning Napoleon's army, which was a glorious thing, but ultimately the French colonizers made them pay a heavy price for their freedom. For one, the U.S. and France imposed a crippling economic embargo on Haiti from 1804 until 1863. And France forced Haiti to pay reparations to remain independent and avoid having the European power return and take over once again. This became known as Haiti's double debt. With a ransom demanded by the former enslaver and a loan Haiti was forced to pay for decades, that loan, which amounted to $560 million in today's money, but ultimately deprived the Haitian economy of $25 billion, helped enrich French banks and placed Haiti on a long road of resource starvation and taking out even more loans. It is no wonder that Haiti is one of the poorest countries in the world. And where the French left off in the exploitation of Haiti, America picked up. The U.S. invaded Haiti in 1915 and stayed until 1934, killing 15,000 Haitians, establishing a forced labor system, and robbing the country as imperialists do. For example, the U.S. Marines stole Haiti's $500,000 gold reserve and handed it over to the Wall Street Bank, now known as Citibank. U.S. intervention. Meanwhile, Uncle Sam propped up brutal and corrupt dictators such as François Papadoc Duvalier, who ruled Haiti from 1957 until his death in 1971, and was followed by his son, Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier, who was, quote, president for life, until 1986. These men imprisoned, tortured, and murdered thousands of Haitians and stole millions of dollars from their people. Fast forward to 2004, and we see the origins of the unrest in Haiti today. Quote, Haiti has been and continues to be the main laboratory for U.S. imperial machinations in the region and throughout the world, end quote, said Jemima Pierre, professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at UCLA and a research associate at the Center for the Study of Race, Gender, and Class at the University of Johannesburg. According to Pierre, the 2004 coup d'etat against Haiti President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, backed by the U.S., Canada, and France, and supported by the UN, is at the root of the current problems. Quote, and the U.S. Marines flew into his home, put him on a plane with his security officials, his wife, and his aide, and flew them to the Central African Republic, Pierre told Democracy Now!, calling the present crisis in Haiti a crisis of imperialism and accusing the world of unwittingly participating in the occupation of Haiti. The world exploitation of Haiti continued. The UN peacekeepers, stationed in Haiti from 2004 to 17, raped hundreds of women, fathered and abandoned hundreds of children, and sexually abused children. The U.S. and the NGOs took advantage of the 2010 Haitian earthquake to provide much of the relief aid to contractors rather than local people, and imposed economic policies that hurt the Haitian economy and destroyed local agriculture. Haiti, the first black republic, was punished for liberating itself, and the nation continues to serve a life sentence in the most recent crisis. Notice that other countries have dictated what will become of Haiti to this day, and Haitians have been denied control over their own destiny. Until Haiti has a right to self-determination, its occupation continues. At the bottom, a note on this author, David A. Love, is a journalist and commentator who writes investigative stories and op-eds on a variety of issues, including politics, social justice, human rights, race, criminal justice, and inequality. Love is also an instructor at the Rutgers School of Communication and Information, where he trains students in a social justice journalism lab. In addition to his journalism career, Love has worked as an advocate and leader in the nonprofit sector, served as a legislative aide, and as a law clerk to two federal judges. He holds a BA in East Asian Studies from Harvard University and a JD from the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He also completed the joint program in International Human Rights Law at the University of Oxford. His portfolio website is davidalove.com. Next, articles from blacknews.com. 10-year-old black girl from Indiana honored for saving two people's lives. This was written back in January, posted January 23rd. I don't see an author's name yet. Anaris Belafont, a 10-year-old African-American girl from Indiana, has been hailed as a hero for saving two people's lives. She was honored with an award by Henry County Sheriff John M. Sproles for her quick thinking that saved lives. On January 8th, Anaris called 911 after she found a man passed out in a car near her place. She also saw a lady knocked out near the car. She thought they weren't breathing and she couldn't see any other adults around. Amidst the situation, Anaris did not panic. She helped out the emergency personnel by telling them exactly where to find the two adults. She stayed on the line, keeping dispatchers updated on the condition of the two adults. When the medics arrived, they used Narcan on both of them before rushing them to Henry Community Health Hospital. One of the adults even ended up in the ICU. Meanwhile, the sheriff's office put up a post on social media saying, "Anaris, you are a true hero. Two adults are alive today because you courageously took control of the emergency situation you found yourself in. You did all of the right things." Next one, posted March 13th. Founder of Black-owned Independent Baseball League launches 30 games in 30 days. And I do not see an author's name here either. Mike Maiden, a former Major League Baseball scout and now the founder of A League of Our Own, (ALOOO), the only black-owned independent baseball league in the United States, is inviting black-owned businesses to take advantage of available sponsorship opportunities. In September 2024, the 501c3 nonprofit organization will schedule 30 games in 30 days and is looking to develop a network of boosters, financial supporters, donors, sponsors, and/or underwriters to help sustain and cultivate the future growth of the league. Smith comments, quote, "We are appealing directly to black entrepreneurs, community and church leaders, and the people of the black community at large to make themselves a committee of one and make a financial donation to help support the longevity of our league." He continues, "Since 1986, we have afforded inner-city baseball players the opportunity to play baseball in New York, Ohio, Missouri, Illinois, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Kentucky, Indiana, Virginia, West Virginia, Minnesota, Tennessee, Wisconsin, Florida, Canada, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, and Hawaii, etc. Over 200 baseball players from his program have gone on to play college and or professional baseball." And it says here, end quote, "ALOOO is a league dedicated to the generations of baseball players who were denied the opportunity to play because of factors other than their ability to play the game. Its objective is to promote diversity in baseball provide family entertainment, and serve as an outlet for African-American baseball players to continue playing. The nonprofit is offering a fall league that starts at the first week of September through the first week of October with nonstop baseball, 30 games in 30 days. The league is open to local, national, and international baseball players from all ethnic backgrounds, 18 years old and older, who may or may not have completed their high school or college eligibility. Maiden comments, quote, "We look to serve as a bridge and extension for participants who have aged out of their local inner-city baseball initiatives and would normally be out of options, but still need additional time to hone their skills. That is where we come in," end quote. ALOOO provides an outlet for players to continue to compete and develop their skills with a focus on playing at the college or professional level. In addition, it will offer an entrepreneurship training program that introduces participants to the process of becoming a self-employed entrepreneur, parentheses, sports management, media production, umpiring, sports agent, and grounds crew maintenance training, etc. The league will also be honoring the following distinguished African-American baseball icons by naming teams in the league after them for their legacy, history, and accomplishments. : R. Foster, Chicago Elite Giants; Satchel Paige, All-Stars; Sam Allen, Monarchs; and Dick Allen, Hitman. Currently under review for future team naming are former Negro League, Chicago Cubs, and MLB icons Ernie Banks, Billy Williams, and Buck O'Neill. The league is also open to more suggestions. How to be a sponsor. To be a sponsor, interested ones can visit the league's website at www.ALOOO247.com. Click Donation and make a donation of $1,500, $250, $100, or more to help the nonprofit organization reach its budget of $175,000 in the next 30 days. All contributions are eligible for tax write-off. For players interested in trying out for a team, visit their website, www.ALOOO247.com, or contact phone number 205-264-1468. Next article. This 11-year-old cowgirl made history competing at the first nationally televised black rodeo. Still reading from blacknews.com, and this was posted March 5th, but still no author's note. Meet Courtney Solomon. That's spelled K-O-R-T-N-E-E. A fourth-generation Texas cowgirl who was only 11 years old when she competed in the first nationally televised black rodeo back in 2021. Courtney, who was born and raised in Texas, comes from a family deeply rooted in rodeo history, according to Andscape. Her mother, Kanisha Jackson, is an 11-time invitational champion, and her father, Corey Solomon, is a professional Rodeo Cowboys Association tie-down roper. Courtney's grandmother, Stephanie Haynes, boasts 18 invitational championships and served on the Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo Board, while her grandfather, Sedgwick Haynes, was the rodeo's general manager before his passing. At just 5 years old, Courtney made her debut at the Bill Pickett Rodeo. She has since secured numerous championships in ladies' barrel and junior breakaway events. The Bill Pickett Invitational, one of the oldest black-owned rodeo circuits, joined forces with professional bull riders for the showdown in Vegas in 2021, showcasing seven pro events like bareback riding and calf roping. Courtney, along with other cowboys and cowgirls who participated, made their mark in the historic event that marked the first nationally televised black rodeo. The young cowgirl's world involves more than just mastering rodeo techniques. She and her mom, based in Hempstead, Texas, care for their horses, handling everything from feeding and grooming to training and riding. Jackson Courtney's mom emphasized their unique connection with the horses, each with its distinct personality. The rodeo season usually spans May to September, with at least one event every weekend. Despite the commitment to the sport, her mother said it is important for Courtney to have a regular childhood, participating in dance, gymnastics, cheerleading, and basketball. Courtney, often the only girl in competitions, remains focused on her performance, setting aside time before each run for solitary contemplation. She said, quote, "Before I run, I like to be by myself and to think about what I am going to do in that run." And next one posted, March 5th also, Black Meetings and Tourism Magazine celebrates 30th anniversary with the launch of the Black America 250 National Initiative, no author's name. As the exclusive award-winning African-American-owned trade publication for the travel and hospitality industry, Black Meetings and Tourism Magazine celebrates 30 years of publishing with the launching of Black America 250, trademark, a national media and marketing initiative that commemorates this country's 250th anniversary. On July 4th, 2026, something phenomenal will occur in our country, and we are all positioned to be a significant part of it. On that day, the United States of America will commemorate its 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, the semi-quincentennial. Already, the eyes of the world are focused on this nation as many activities and media events, which are tied to plans for celebrating that momentous occasion, are in development. In keeping with the mission of the nonpartisan U.S. Semi-Quincentennial Commission created by Congress, quote, to design and implement initiatives and programs that honor our first 250 years and inspire Americans to imagine our next 250, end quote, the publishers of Black Meetings and Tourism Magazine, BMNT, in association with the National Association of Black Hotel Owners, Operators, and Developers, the Travel Professionals of Color, the National Policy Alliance, Mojo Marketing and PR, and the regional CAL Black Chamber SFV, has launched Black America 250. This is a multi-year media and marketing initiative which showcases the legacy and contributions of African Americans in this country by amplifying the triumphs, resiliency, and resourcefulness that they have demonstrated during this nation's 250-year history. John Garrison Marks, author of Black Freedom in the Age of Slavery, Race, Status, and Identity in the Urban America, recently said in Time magazine, quote, "Beyond simply celebrating the revolution, the semi-quincentennial commemoration is also an opportunity to share American history that fully explores the diverse people and complex events of our country's past," end quote. To get additional information on Black America 250, visit, and these words all have capital letters at the beginning, theblackamerica250.com. The 250 is numbers. So once again, that's theblackamerica250.com. Be sure to take the Black America 250 destination quiz to be entered in a drawing to win merchandise. Moving now to blackenterprise.com. This first article written by Mary Spiller. It was published February 25th. Birmingham mayor advises black athletes to steer clear of Alabama colleges if anti-diversity bill passes. Mayor Randall Woodfin says the bill is detrimental to minority student athletes coming to the state for their education. Birmingham, Alabama Mayor Randall Woodfin took to social media to express his discontent with a new bill coming up through the courts. He said that if Alabama passes a bill that bans diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, programs in public schools and universities, parents of minority student-athletes should choose colleges in other states, quote, where diversity and inclusion are prioritized, end quote. Woodfin referenced the Alabama Senate's approval of the proposed bill, which bars schools from affirming, quote, divisive concepts such as, quote, slavery and racism are aligned with the founding principles of the United States, end quote. The bill claims that, quote, fault, blame, or bias should be assigned to members of a race, color, religion, sex, ethnicity, or national origin based on race, color, religion, sex, ethnicity, or national origin, end quote. The only thing keeping the bill from being signed is a House vote. Woodfin urged, quote, leadership, athletic directors, and coaches to consider what the bill is saying. He continued in his post, quoting, to the parents of minority athletes who are helping their children decide if they want to play sports at these institutions, would you be cool with your child playing at schools where diversity among staff is actively being discouraged? End quote. Or he goes on, quotes, although I am the biggest Bama fan, I have no problem organizing black parents and athletes to attend other institutions outside of the state where diversity and inclusion are prioritized. If supporting inclusion becomes illegal in this state, hell, you might as well stand in front of the school door like Governor George Wallace, end quote. Woodfin's post drummed up a lot of responses, both positive and negative. One Birmingham resident, Keena Clark, showed her support of Woodfin's stance. Clark said, quote, he faces a lot of criticism for any position that he takes because he's a Democrat in a Republican-run state. He shows his character and his caring about us as a people. He's willing to face the criticism and stand up for what we deal with as black people here. End quote. Next article, published February 21st, written by Nala Abdur Rahman. The University of Maryland Eastern Shore to become second HBCU to have veterinarian school. The University of Maryland Eastern Shore is making strides in diversity, becoming the second HBCU to host a veterinarian program. The University of Maryland Eastern Shore in Princess Anne, Maryland, is set to become the second HBCU to have a veterinarian school. Classes are set to begin in 2026. Not only will the school join Tuskegee University as the only HBCU in the nation to have a program like that, it will soon be part of the just over three dozen schools that grant the degree. As reported by USA Today, granting more opportunities for aspiring black veterinarians. Quote, we are hoping that our new school will open the door and create plenty of opportunities in an underserved field, said, end quote, said Moses Cairo, the Dean of Agricultural and Natural Sciences at the university, he went on. There are very few vet schools being established, so there's room for growth. We feel our timing is just right. Black veterinarians only make up 1.2% of all professionals in the United States, according to a Bureau of Labor Statistics report from 2021. Quote, the bottom line is we need more veterinarians of all races from all backgrounds, end quote, said Stacy Purcell, CEO of the Vet Recruiter. He went on, it's a much bigger picture than just race. There are very limited spots at veterinary schools, and they turn away more students than they can accept, end quote. The establishment of the school and its designated building will be part of the university's $60 million fundraising campaign. The grand scale operation also happens to be the largest financial plan in the school's history. A portion of the raised funds expected to go toward the construction of its veterinarian studies building, as well as updates to its farm so that students can have access to hands-on practice. The school anticipates hosting an accelerated 3-year program with a year-round curriculum equal to the rigor met at other prestigious veterinary schools. According to its interim dean, Dr. Kimberly Braxton, the UMES is taking steps to ensure that future generations of Black veterinarians are prepared to overcome a shortage in a vital field. Braxton said, quote, "It's a huge task, but a good task to have." Next article published March 9th, written by Lauren Nuttall. Black doctors challenge misconceptions and increase diversity in chiropractic field. Aligned for Life Wellness is changing the landscape of chiropractic care. And that four is the number four. Doctors Joseph Fowler Jr. and Brandon K. Williams founded Aligned for Life Wellness in Atlanta with the hopes of changing the way chiropractic therapy is viewed and providing access to under-resourced groups. The two innovators spoke to Black Enterprise about their unconventional use of modern technology, the need for more Black people in the field, and how they are challenging common misconceptions about their work. Quote, "As it stands today, the chiropractic profession is less than 2.5% Black, meaning that less than 2.5% of providers within the profession are African American," said Williams, who went on, "So it has been our charge and our mission to tackle that disparity, increase the representation amongst African Americans and other people of color within the profession. Through our philanthropic RMIT nonprofit foundation, we started a scholarship program geared toward those people of color, particularly African Americans, who wish to pursue an education in chiropractic," end quote. With this initiative, Fowler and Williams have helped offer more opportunities to aspiring and underrepresented chiropractors. Fowler added, quote, "It started in grad school together because we noticed the difference in the number of Blacks, male or female, versus whites or any other groups in grad school. And so the graduation rate is significantly lower for us for many reasons. It could be academics, it could be finances, or whatever. But when the graduation rate is lower and our numbers begin lower, we saw the need, and being able to offer scholarships is part of our purpose," end quote. This focus on inclusivity has encouraged the doctors to invest in their communities in an effort to introduce more people to their craft and ease hesitancy regarding chiropractic treatment, which has been plagued by assumptions. Williams explained, quote, "I think one of the greatest misnomers, if you will, is that chiropractic is harmful to the body, or it can cause damage to the body, or it can be dangerous or anything like that. But I always say this, going to your chiropractor is no more dangerous to you than to see your primary care physician. We practice and utilize safe techniques. We go through some of the same education and training that medical doctors do. The first 2 years of chiropractic school are, in many cases, synonymous with the first 2 years of medical school," end quote. While there are similarities, there are still significant distinctions between the practices. For one, chiropractors do not perform surgery. Rather, that responsibility is reserved for specific medical practitioners. Still, chiropractors like Fowler and Williams are especially well-versed in toxicology, which is a vital aspect of their practice, as it allows them to understand how their clients' medication will interact with their adjustments. Another misguided notion about the career is that it is a simple massage rather than a realignment. The doctors elaborated on the science behind their work and challenged the reductive view of the profession. Fowler shared, quote, "When we get through working on you, you will feel like you have a massage because, as chiropractors, we work on the nervous system. When chiropractic is done properly, we work on the nervous system, especially the central nervous system, which consists of the brain and spinal cord. All your other systems, hormones, immune, respiratory, reproductive, muscular, skeletal, and urinary, it doesn't matter, they all run off of that central nervous system," end quote. In their comprehensive overview of chiropractic care, Fowler and Williams have successfully built a multidisciplinary network of nutritionists, trainers, and other professionals to help provide their patients with additional care. Moving now to the Denverite online publication. This was posted March 14th, written by Isaac Vargas. Denver Black Restaurant Week: What It Means to Local Owners and a List of Businesses Participating. Black Restaurant Week, goes by BRW, Denver, will run this Friday, March 15th to the 24th. Mississippi Boy Catfish and Ribs owner Ty Allen knew that by dishing out smoked turkey legs, homemade shrimp, and sausage gumbo, his Northeast Park Hill restaurant could compete with the flavors offered at five-star establishments across the city. Quote, "We can rival them with the environment, and we will definitely rival them with the quality of food," end quote, Allen said of his restaurant, which opened in 2021. With the return of Black Restaurant Week, BRW, Denver, Allen and others hope that will lead to more locals lending their attention and support to Black-owned culinary businesses as they do some of those higher-end restaurants. The second annual BRW will run March 15th through the 24th. BRW is solely guided by business owners and operators, said Falane Farrell, Black Restaurant Week LLC's operations managing partner. She goes on, quote, "They are in the trenches every day and experience the ebbs and flows of running a business during one of the most difficult periods in U.S. history," end quote. A little over 50% of independent restaurant owners and operators surveyed reported lower profits in 2023 compared to the prior year. Founder of BRW, Warren Luckett, started the One City Food Experience in Houston back in 2016 with the intention of providing complimentary marketing and PR services for businesses, as well as, quote, "educate consumers on the abundance of cultural cuisines within their neighborhood and share the disparities faced by minority-owned businesses," end quote. Well, Luckett shared also in a statement, quote, "From being overlooked for revitalization funds to inflation, most Black-owned culinary businesses cannot afford advertisements/PR/marketing to build awareness and attract consumers. That's why we proudly do this for free. It's peer-to-peer support for 10 days within each market and for the past 9 years. This is what some of Denver's business owners say BRW means to them. Allen believes the impact of BRW is in bringing mainstream attention to Black restaurant owners and businesses. Allen said, quote, "North Park Hill, from a restaurant standpoint, it's a bit underserved. There's approximately 2 restaurants that are non-chain in this area," end quote. Amassing a long line of hungry supporters at events, like last year's Taste of the South Festival, Allen said all of their beloved food is homemade and prepped with in-house seasonings, meaning they rarely, if ever, need to refill the salt and pepper shakers on the tables of their restaurants. Another one of those special places is Southeast Denver Seafood Restaurant, TK's Surf and Turf Kitchen. Tyler, Chef TK Conway, opened the spot in 2020 and curated his restaurant's menu around his 100% butter secret sauce that is doused all over crab clusters, shrimp, lobster tail, and more. Conway said, I'm pretty much living out my father's dream. My actual restaurant was something I started out of my house," end quote. Well, Conway went on, quote, "As Denver natives, we're definitely happy to serve and feed our community. There's nothing like bringing people together over food, regardless of race, color, creed. Everyone gets hungry." I won't have time for the addresses, but I'll name the names of the restaurants that are participating. Little Bodega, Smoke and Bones Barbecue, TK's Surf and Turf Kitchen, Walia Creamery, Toby's New Orleans Po' Boys, Teely's Tea House and Bookstore, Matty's Soul Food Bar and Lounge, My King's Ice Cream, Sweet Sweets Ice Cream and Desserts, Taste Bud Bullies, Agave Shore, Mississippi Boy Catfish and Ribs. That brings me to the end of our time for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for the Black Experience Hour.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.